This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you drive around Detroit, you may be aware of a concrete barrier that cuts through the northwest part of town. Maybe you know, maybe you don't. This wall is a holdover from some of the most overtly racist housing policies of the 20th century. The story of the Burwood Wall was retold this month by a pair of reporters in town. Erin Einhorn is a national reporter based in Detroit for NBC Digital, and Olivia Lewis is a reporter with Bridge Detroit. They talked to a whole host of people for the story that tells about the Burwood Wall in the words of the people who live along it.
The wall is directly across the street from my house. I could stand in my front door or in my front living room window and I could see the wall. One question people always ask me is, do you want the wall to be torn down? No, I don't. The history of what went on, why it went on, and how we can change things, that history needs to be told.
That's interview sound from the NBC News digital video, A Segregation Wall Still Standing, The Legacy of Detroit's Burwood Wall. It can also be found on the Bridge Detroit website. And these two reporters who did the story are with us now, Erin Einhorn and Olivia Lewis. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
In the article, you write, the divider, which is called the Burwood Wall, the 8 Mile Wall, or the Wailing Wall, can't be blamed for inventing segregation, but the barrier and the policies that led to its existence would have far-reaching repercussions for the people, both black and white, who lived in its shadow. Let's start by talking about Detroit when the wall was built in the 1940s. Olivia, what did the neighborhood look like at that time?
Right, so what Erin and I have found is that this neighborhood actually started off as nothing originally, and then that there was a few Black families, specifically the Cruz family that we highlight in this story, that came to this part that wasn't even Detroit at the time and started to build these tar paper shacks and eventually built this small neighborhood called, that was a shack town at the time. And so originally it was a Black neighborhood, and then as time went on and as housing needs increased in Detroit, there were developers who wanted to build a neighborhood for white residents and needed to use the wall to create space between the Black and white neighborhoods.
There was a really beautiful detail in the story. You were talking to a woman named Margaret Watson, who's very old now, who remembers the wall being built in her neighborhood. And she talked about roller skating as a kid and how all of a sudden these paved streets were getting built where she could skate so much faster than on the dirt roads that had been there prior. And Margaret Watson is Black. And even it sounds like even then she knew that all this wasn't intended for her family.
Yeah. So there was, you know, there were these houses, these more or less shacks, and it was a rural area. It had been Greenfield Township, so right outside the city, you know, and the city of Detroit annexed that area in the 20s because Detroit was growing really fast. So the population of Detroit tripled between 1910 and 1930, and people really needed housing. And so the developers, you know, had all these big plans. And we actually went and found like ads in the newspaper for these sort of new neighborhoods, you know, the future of Detroit, all this progress. And they were, you know, the city was just growing really fast. And so developers had big plans for this neighborhood. There was a neighborhood called Blackstone Park Number 6. And, you know, the fact that there had been a historic community of Black homeowners who, you know, had big dreams for permanent houses that they wanted to build on these lots. They were able to buy, it's actually a pretty extraordinary story that they were able to buy this land in the first place, you know, at a time when in the city of Detroit, they were restricted to, you know, Black Bottom and Paradise Valley, a couple of neighborhoods that were becoming really, really overcrowded. So at the time of the Great Migration, you have Black folks coming up from the South. But, you know, white developers had their eyes on that land, too. And so they planned this community. And Margaret Watson, as you say, is, you know, she was a child, you know, living in this neighborhood, and all of a sudden there's all these like paved streets. She lived on a dirt road. There's all these like paved streets and like a tic-tac-toe board by her house that she can like roller skate on. Her father before that had a, she described it as a garden the size of a city block. You know, he'd come from the South and, you know, he built this garden, and, you know, all of a sudden now she's seeing this new community come in. But in order, sort of because of the housing policy at the time, the federal housing policy, the white developers thought that the only way they could build their new community was by putting up a wall that separated the white neighborhood they were building from the black one that was there before that.
I mean, was there any official on paper justification for the wall to try to smooth over its purpose, Olivia? Or was the literal segregation just something that people accepted?
Yeah, so it was interesting. Some of the news clippings that we found, it talks about how there will be this great new housing subdivision. And then in fine print, it kind of says, this is what we're looking for in terms of people to live here.
Erin?
Yeah, I mean, so the ads had language in it that was sort of coded language for the time that said, you know, these houses are going to have the restrictions that, you know, that give houses their values. And so we went and we found the deed for the property. And then we actually had to get, you know, the restrictions were actually in a different document. And we found this document that we linked to in the story that had basically the whole list, all the restrictions for the neighborhood. And a lot of them are sort of standard zoning things, you know, how high your fence can be and how many stories and how, you know, the setback from the street. And then right there in black and white, it says, you know, that nobody can live here who is not of pure, unmixed white Caucasian race. Spelled it out in, and at the time in this country, that was pretty common in a lot of neighborhoods. They use different language in different neighborhoods, but that was the language that was used here.
It's absolutely fascinating looking at the way some of the different sources in your story perceive this. Again, Margaret Watson, age 93 now, who was just a child when this happened, she picked up right away on the unstated implication that this was to keep black families out. Whereas another man that you talked to, Stephen Bean, who's also very elderly, he said that race just wasn't a major issue at the time, that everybody just sort of got along. I guess it speaks to the divide in who picks up what on this kind of segregation.
Yeah, to me, that was the most telling or the most revelatory thing that we learned in this process. And, you know, we talked to dozens of people, black and white, who grew up, you know, near the wall. And for the most part, you know, the white folks we talked to didn't know the wall was there at the time. Some learned about it more recently, but, you know, certainly growing up, they didn't know the wall was there, or they didn't know why it was there. They didn't know about these deed restrictions in their language. They were surprised to learn. They didn't give much thought to why it is that, you know, most of the people at their elementary school, most of the kids at their elementary school were white. They may not have known that there was another elementary school a few blocks to the east where, you know, the population was overwhelmingly black. You know, they just didn't take the time to think about race. They didn't take the time to ask those questions. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, systemic racism and structural racism. Those are phrases that we use a lot today, but I don't know that white people in particular, necessarily understand the mechanism of that or understand the way necessarily that they benefited. Parents and grandparents could buy houses that other people couldn't. They had access to loans. And when, you know, folks don't have that awareness necessarily about how they benefited, you know, they say, well, they look at Detroit or parts of Detroit that aren't doing well, and they say, oh, you know, what a shame, you know, why does this neighborhood look that way and doesn't look the way my neighborhood looks? Doesn't have the vacancy or you know, and think, you know, maybe they think uncharitable thoughts about the people who live there rather than sort of acknowledge the systems that were put in place that helped create that dynamic.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Erin Einhorn of NBC News Digital and Olivia Lewis of Bridge Detroit. They worked on a story called A Segregation Wall Still Standing, The Legacy of Detroit's Burwood Wall. Olivia, how would you say the ramifications of this wall have persisted in people's lives in modern day Detroit?
Yeah, so I think that while this is, yes, a very obvious physical representation of unjust and racist policies that are baked into America, there are so many things that when we look at them, although they may be beautiful on the outside, because now the wall is brightly colored, it has all of these murals. And if you didn't know anything about it, you would think, oh, well, it's just, you know, an art piece that is within a park, that is be in an alley and behind some homes. You may think that, but then once you dig a little bit deeper, you see that, no, there is some actual true division here where people don't see eye to eye, and where there are long-term, really terrible issues that have persisted that have now affected housing affordability in Detroit, has affected, like Aaron said, how neighborhoods look. When you think about tax bases, it has affected everything in terms of how Detroiters have access to things. You know, like, it's, and I know that's a lot to pack on to say, like, this one or two housing policies did this, but they had long-term ramifications that have affected Detroiters, whether you're a long-term Detroiter or a newcomer to the city.
Yeah. Like Olivia said, the wall is kind of a work of art now. It's been plastered with murals that tell the story of the neighborhood and its residents. Aaron, did you talk to any of the present day neighbors about how they feel about it?
Yeah, I think we talked to quite a few folks. I mean, lots of folks. And in fact, you know, the wall has become a symbol for the neighborhood. So there have this, you know, there's an annual cookout in the community that people come from, you know, wherever they live now, if it's not currently in that neighborhood, and it sort of brings the old timers back. And, you know, as I saw, when we were up in that neighborhood doing this reporting, there was a woman wearing a t-shirt that had a picture of the wall on it, you know, so it's become a little bit of a symbol, you know, particularly more recently, I think, as it's gotten some more attention. And we actually have a line in the story about how the wall now serves, it does the opposite of what it was intended to do. So it was intended to divide. But now, I mean, and you know, now it no longer divides racially. And in fact, it didn't divide racially for very long, because of white flight, you know, that the white folks mostly left. And it's been Black folks living on both sides of that wall, you know, since the 50s and certainly since the 60s. But it, you know, sort of as the wall becomes better known, you have tour groups kind of pulling up. And we talked to a woman, Teresa Moon, who can see the wall from her house. And whenever she sees a tour group coming up, she'll go out and introduce herself. And, you know, she, the final line of our story is her saying, you know, I want them not just to know the history of the wall, you know, I want them to know my community, you know, these folks, you know, and it was also really striking. I mean, this wasn't all negative. And, you know, in a lot of ways, the history of this neighborhood is about the strong Black community that grew in this neighborhood, sort of in spite of its history. You know, you had these really impressive activists who were on the east side of the wall, the Black side of the wall, who saw the wall as this humiliating insult, and were inspired by it to advocate for change. And they wrote all these letters to elected officials, including the president of the United States, FDR. And, you know, that got the attention of the Michigan Housing Authority director, who, you know, ended up backing their cause. And they were actually able to get access to the federally backed mortgages that in most Black neighborhoods weren't available. So that in this one neighborhood, they have this, you know, this crazy, very, you know, sort of unusual success story, you know, and then, you know, then the white folks leave, and the community that's there, you know, Black folks sort of jump to the other side of the wall, and, you know, they're living in these houses that were sort of much higher quality, you know, front and backyards and sidewalks, and, you know, the local rec center had a pool and all this, you know, this really great community that was able to thrive there for decades. you know, made possible in some ways by these racist policies. I mean, you know, obviously it's more complicated than that and more complex than that. But you had this neighborhood that was built to divide ultimately ends up being this, you know, thriving Black community.
The wall on the surface seems removed in time from anything we might see today. But at the same time, there are still physical divisions all over Michigan and Metro Detroit. I mean, just a few years ago, the community of Grosse Pointe was trying to create physical barriers blocking Detroiters from using certain neighborhood streets. And there are still very much alive conversations in the points about how many of those barriers they can get taken down now. Did you guys get any sense of whether something like this is happening again, whether or not we acknowledge it?
You know, I don't know that this is happening again, at least in Detroit, from a like a physical visual structure, but I can see it happening in a lot of the policies that are happening. So there's people have talked about this in terms of access to voting or especially when we think about the last presidential election, you know, how did policy affect the way that votes were counted? How did it affect the way people showed up to vote? So I think that things like this are popping up again. I don't know that they ever went away. They're just showing up in different ways.
Was there anything else that I didn't ask either of you that came out of this reporting process that kind of surprised you or struck you?
I want to say that I think one thing that we really wanted to include and something that was super helpful in our reporting was also listening to the lived experience of Detroiters. And so being able to go back and hear from people who grew up in this neighborhood, whether they were Black or white, and learn about their experiences, I think was super important in how we were able to frame this story, but also how we were able to find this information, you know, of like, how do we connect with people and figure out who's still living in this neighborhood? Like, it was really interesting to also hear that there were a few people who they have lived in this neighborhood for a long time. And so I think just having people who we could call and learn about their lived experience was very important and something that I'm actually really thankful for in terms of how this story came out. And then also the one other thing is that my mom actually read the story and she saw it and she said, like, she had told me about the wall. She grew up very close to this neighborhood. And she was like, you know what? I always knew that this wall was here, but I never knew like exactly how it came to be or like why the homes on one side looked a little bit different than the other side. And so it was really fascinating to hear her like process this so many years later.
Olivia Lewis is a journalist with Bridge Detroit, and we've also been talking with Aaron Einhorn with NBC News Digital, a national reporter based in Detroit. They collaborated on a story about Detroit's Burwood Wall. It can be seen at NBC News Digital and at Bridge Detroit right now. There's some really interesting stuff in there about the builder of the wall that even Detroit scholars may not be aware of. Olivia, Aaron, it's great talking to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.